Hi, this is Day for Night with Caridad's Finch, a series that looks at the intersection between theater and poetry in the Edgelands, in the wilderness. In today's episode, I'm going to read an essay from a book that I'm in called Shakespeare and Latinidad. It's a book edited by Trevor Buffone and Carla de la Gata, and it's published by Edinburgh University Press. Really terrific book looking at Latinx artists intersecting with Shakespeare from a variety of perspectives. Highly recommend the book. The essay that I contributed is in the second chapter, which is called Making Shakespeare Latinx. And my essay is called In a Shakespearean Key. I was living in Hialeah, Florida when I was in the fourth grade, nestled somewhat uncomfortably in a Cuban American and immigrant Cuban neighborhood while studying at a Catholic elementary school. I reached for a copy of A Midsummer Night's Dream on my school library shelf because both the title and the cover looked inviting and seemed like an escape from the everyday concerns of being a multicultural American South. Now, it may seem odd to signify the Cuban American enclave of Hialeah in the 1970s as part of the American South. In the collective consciousness of the United States, the South usually evokes complex, necessarily troubled images of the American Civil War, the history of slave trade and labor, Dust Bowl era displacement, civil rights era protests, signifiers of, quote, redneck, unquote, countries, deep poverty and racism, and Black communities steeped in the legacy and sound of the diasporic Delta Blues. But the South is also indigenous, Spanish, Creole, Cajun, Asian, Mexican, Haitian, Dominican, Puerto Rican, and Cuban, among many other ethnic markers. It's interesting how convenient it is for the Spanish colonial, immigrant, and native Latinx cultures of the South, especially, to be erased in discussions of its history. But the suburb of Miami named Hialeah is most definitely in the South. And in the 1970s, it was predominantly a working-class city populated by immigrant Cubans and first-generation Cuban-Americans. I landed there direct from living in both Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Paterson, New Jersey, when my Cuban, Spanish, and Argentine-Croatian parents moved to pursue a new job opportunity. In the neighborhoods in which I had lived before, we were usually the only Latinx family on the block. Spanish was spoken at home and English outside. I grew up thus with a clear separation between the language of home and the language of the world. But in Hialeah at that time, there was no separation. Spanish was everywhere. On storefront window signs, on the street, in the music that blared from radios, and in the chisme heard at school, where about 80% of my classmates were first-generation Latinxers. Now, to say that landing in Hialeah was a culture shock for me is to put it mildly. As a young person starting to shape their identity, I felt almost betrayed by the sudden lack of separation between home and world, as I had previously perceived it, especially from a linguistic perspective. If there was no separation, then how could I navigate the boundaries of my existence? If what had felt private before was no longer so, where could I find a semblance of privacy? A Midsummer Night's Dream held the key. With its ornate cover, the Folger Library edition of the play sat on a shelf in the school library alongside single editions of Hamlet and Othello, and larger volumes that grouped Shakespeare's history plays, comedies, and tragedies. Now, somehow the romances were relegated to the much bigger collected works tome, which seemed far too heavy to carry in my plaid book bag. Opening the pages of Midsummer, I fell into a very strange world indeed. And it is important to consider how strange this play that we take for granted these days truly is. I mean, here we have a fairy king and queen, a set of restless and reckless young mortals caught in the wild entanglements of mimetic desire, a shape-shifting sprite hell-bent on making mischief, a company of traveling community actors that are rehearsing a play for the mortal king and queen, not to be confused with the fairy king and queen, a band of fairies and creatures, a man who turns into an ass and makes love to the fairy queen, and more. If the plot of this play were to synopsize to a theater these days, I am sure they would think it made little sense and demand it be made accessible at once. But thankfully, this strange play exists in all its queer charm and dark magic. My initiation into Shakespeare could not have been more prescient. Its spell is all over my playwriting to this day, even in the plays that have very little visible marking of Shakespeare's influence. In Midsummer, I found not only intoxicating poetry and images meant to be performed, but also for the first time, although I was already a voracious reader, a door into another world. If I was wrestling indeed with being a Yankee in the South, then Elizabethan England, or should I say, Shakespeare's rendering of a British Attica, where an Amazonian Greek queen, Hippolyta, and a Greek king, Theseus, preside, and where a figure from medieval English literature, like Oberon, meets a newly coined fairy queen, Titania, was a deliriously exciting portal through which to allow my imagination to enter. Soon, I was reading more Shakespeare on my own, not quite understanding it, but nonetheless struck by the beauty and wildness of the language and the dramatic situations. Part of my day, I was eating rice and beans and listening to boleros, rumbas, and salsa, and in the other part of my day, I was spirited headlong into writing that felt neither Yankee nor Latinx, but maybe perhaps an odd fusion of both. I joke with some of my colleagues that I consider Shakespeare as Latinx as Euripides, Tennessee Williams, Sam Shepard, and Entushoka Shange, all significant early influences for me. Although they come from disparate theater traditions, ethnicities, and upbringings, the radical positioning of these writers' works as they contemplate human existence feels like kin to me. I'm here to challenge what may already be essentialized identity-based readings of Latinx writing. Julio Cortázar, Jorge Luis Borges, Roberto Bolaño, and Clarice Lispector, for example, all drew from writing influences outside their countries of birth. Cortázar was enamored of Jules Verne and Edgar Allan Poe's works. Bolaño loved the Beat Generation writers. Borges was inspired by Schopenhauer, Marinetti, Apollinaire, and Oscar Wilde. Lispector contested Kafka. In Shakespeare, before he was a writer on my syllabus in high school, and therefore part of the colonial violence of the canon that I was told I must rebel against, I started to find a sense of home. In this other language, poetic, daring, and inventive, mixing in what we may call a syncretic manner, high and low registers, philosophical thought, and fearless commitment to the possibilities of the stage, I began to connect the different ways I experienced and used Spanish and English daily, and to understand how this so-called Yankee, whose early identity was forged in the industrial landscape of the Northeast, was a Southern writer. In Florida and later in North Carolina, where I spent my formative years in high school and college, I began to think about theater, and specifically writing for the theater. although the Northeast has always been in my blood. Attica, England, Hialeah, and Charlotte are my touchstones when I make plays, and no more so than in a play like 12 Ophelias, which cracks open Shakespeare's Hamlet to create a new identity for one of literature's most troubled women. Set in a neo-Elizabethan Appalachian landscape, 12 Ophelias, originally dated 2008, began as a bluegrass play. Drawing from the sounds and musical traditions of bluegrass, deeply influenced by the folk archives of murder ballads and mountain songs of this part of the South, the play is structured like a negative mirror of Hamlet. In it, Ophelia rises from the water to find herself in a new world that's populated by ghosts from her literary past. These ghosts are not the same as when she last saw them in Shakespeare's play. Gertrude now runs a brothel. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are androgynous gossips that do the emotional and physical labor of cleaning and tending to the town. Hamlet is now called Rude Boy. Horatio is simply called H. And someone not from her past at all, a young woman named Mina, a sex worker in Gertrude's house, becomes her spirit guide. A chorus is also living in this terrain, and this chorus is made of other Ophelias, young, neglected women driven mad and abused by patriarchal systems that never listened to them or that negated their voices and beings. The play poem is composed in a series of short scenes, some of which remix, distort, and fracture language from Shakespeare's Hamlet, alongside nonverbal scenes, dances, and songs that illuminate what I like to call the soul terrain of the play. Instead of advancing the plot, the songs in 12 Ophelias are windows into consciousness, and specific to this play, once affected by trauma. A conventional Latinx reading of the play would locate Ophelia's trauma of entry into a new world after having committed suicide as an analogy for the trauma of exile and repatriation, of a border crossing in which one leaves behind and yet cannot leave behind the ghosts of the old country, and of a colonized being remaking herself as the post-colonial author of her own narrative, subjugated no more. Such a reading would be fair to consider, though I would like to problematize it just a bit. In my contestation, response, and reclaiming of Shakespeare from a feminist, queer, and phenomenological perspective, influenced by Helene Cissou, Judith Butler, and Sarah Ahmed, I am also reconnecting with Shakespeare in the way I did back when I picked up Midsummer from the library shelf, allowing myself to be transported to another world and an other language, but also acknowledging that this language is mine too. In the same way that I ask audiences to contemplate the fact that a Latinx writer finds herself at home in bluegrass, I am doing the same with Shakespeare. Yes, canon exists, and yes, Shakespeare is part of it, but he has been placed there not by his own doing, but rather by the academy and the field. The point may seem small, but it is still crucial. Great writing knows no borders, in and out of translation. If it is awake, alert, and filled with the spirit of deep play, it transcends nation, state, locality, and referentiality by being itself. The sheer dare of the inky signs and soul map on the page. The larger question here is why some works have been asked by governing systems to do a duty outside themselves, to serve as colonizing forces of the imagination on other nations and peoples. Shakespeare intervened in, challenged, and contested existing narratives. He plundered, stole, and remade stories to craft a new image. In a slightly left-of-center way, one could argue that he intervened in the existing canonical works of his time before a canon ever came into being. Questioning and repurposing received text are among our jobs as writers. Querying Shakespeare in 12 Ophelias seems to me a very Shakespeare thing to do. But one could also say that it's a very post-Nueva Trova thing to do. In Cuban popular music, for instance, the Nueva Trova movement was characterized by a return to folk-based songs of protest and reflections of contemporary life. Post-Nueva Trova, then, in my reading of it, is music and work that recognizes what Nueva Trova stood for and moves past it to explore and reanimate the musical landscape through a postmodern, postcolonial lens. In my journeys thus far with reconfiguring Shakespeare's works, 12 Ophelias, The Booth Variations, Perdita Gracia, The Breath of Stars, Holler River, I have used Shakespeare's material as a kind of avatar for my own writing in the way that poets wink at, allude to, and call on other poets' works, or the way composers and musicians riff on and nod at what has become the stream of history. The fact that I am a female writer is not lost on me, because it does mean still that the intervention and reconfiguration is coming from a place of asserting power where once no power was allowed. Making and inscribing a space that had been reserved for men for hundreds of years is a different position from which to write. And for a hybrid Latinx writer, this position is made even more acute. So when I say that this language is mine, I am not only speaking of English, which is my first and primary language, although I learned Spanish at the same time, but also staking a claim as a historically unheard voice to the stage and page, and saying with quite an independent streak in regard to conventional modes of dramatic production and historically gendered expectations of how narrative functions in the theater. I am here, just like Ophelia does in my play. But let me take this a step further. Back when I picked up Midsummer from my library shelf, I also stumbled on Virginia Woolf's work. I was quite a heady fourth grader. And one of the first lightning bolt moments that I had while reading Woolf was an encounter with her own profound wrestling with what it means to be female and be a writer. In my understanding of writing as androgynous, I feel a strong connection to Woolf. We might call this now a genderqueer position, but I would like to stay with the word androgynous for a bit longer, because it cuts to the heart of the beingness of writing, and perhaps to the way that one approaches another writer's work, in the case of this essay, Shakespeare's. In writing, one is everything. One can be everything, which is to say, writing is a free act, and therein lies its most radical otherness. It is not limited to or by, except by outside forces and systems of thought, law, and governance, where a writer is from, or what their cultural makeup may be. If the imagination is free, then it can go anywhere. And the danger and vitality of this acceptance of potentiality, ever-changing, never-fixed, resistance of categorical and essentialized identities, is what gives writing its power against authority. My androgynous I, faces the page with a full knowledge of being female and Latinx, but also with the fact that when this I looks at the blank canvas, they are also thinking about form and shape, line and composition, the complex sounds and etymologies of words, and the way that the southernness of their voice, located in a sur of the North American Eurocentric imaginary, is also the south of the blues, gospel, el son, cantejondo, and its duende, tracing the nomadic trail of song and secular hymns sung in many languages across at least one ocean or two. So that when they inscribe the holler cries of the traumatized soldiers in Holler River, for instance, as a reflection of Falstaff and Hal in King Henry IV, Part 1, It is coming from a third place of seeing. This third space, or maybe by now it is fifth or seventh, depending on one's sense of history, allows for the multiplicity of the eye to render worlds outside themselves and thus simultaneously within. Reading Shakespeare as a precocious youth was a first step in my journey towards understanding the complexities of being a multicultural human, ironically enough. Stumbling across Wolfe led me towards a deeper comprehension of the beautiful instability of identity. Growing up partly in the American South awakened me to the complex, violent, and difficult histories of the United States, especially in its acts of erasure, but also allowed me to recognize and find kinship with cadences desirous of freedom at all costs. And that is my essay in a Shakespearean key from the book Shakespeare and Latinidad. Wonderful book. Get it from Edinburgh University Press, edited by Trevor Buffone and Carla De La Gata. As always, this is about you and I in this theater. You there in the dark, and I here wondering who you are. Thanks for listening today for night.